fitter, happier, more productive, comfortable, not drinking too much, regular exercise at the gym, 3 days a week, getting on better with your associate employee contemporaries, at ease, eating well, no more microwave dinners and saturated fats, a patient better driver, a safer car, baby smiling in backseat, sleeping well, no bad dreams, no paranoia, careful to all animals, never washing spiders down a plug hole, keep in contact with old friends, enjoy a drink now and then, will frequently check credit at moral, bank, hole in wall, favors for favors, fond but not in love, charity standing orders, on Sundays reading road supermarket, no killing moths or putting boiling water on the ants, car wash, also on Sundays, no longer afraid of the dark or midday shadows, nothing so ridiculously teenage and desperate, nothing so childish, at a better pace, slower and more calculated, no chance of escape, now self-employed, concerned, but powerless, an empowered and informed member of society, pragmatism not idealism, will not cry in public, less chance of illness, tires that grip in the wet, shot of baby strapped in backseat, a good memory, still cries at a good film, still kisses with saliva, no longer empty and frantic, like a cat, tied to a stick, that's driven into, frozen winter shit, the ability to laugh at weakness, calm, fitter, healthier, and more productive, a pig, in a cage, on antibiotics.
Biodevastation 2000, the largest ever convergence for action against the biotechnology industry, is coming to Boston March 24th through 30th to create a counterpower to the biotechnology industry organization's Bio 2000 conference. While hundreds of biotech companies strut their stuff in the 5K biotech trek and take out their high cholesterol angst playing biolab tennis, organizers, intellectuals, activists, and farmers from the far reaches of the globe will be exposing the truth about international trade, science, culture, and politics through words and actions. Come join the growing global movement against corporate free trade here in the U.S. on March 24th through 30th. Rise up for Biodevastation 2000. For more information, contact www.biodev.org.
A powerful U.S. movement for economic and human rights and fair trade had its coming out party at the WTO meetings in Seattle. A range of forces who value human and ecological dignity over corporate profits and trickle-down economics came together there. They challenged one of the most insidious tools of unaccountable profit-driven rule, the World Trade Organization, and scored an important series of victories against some daunting odds. In April, the struggle continues in Washington, D.C., the very heart of political and institutional control over the global economy, where the U.S. Treasury, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank are located. They are the chief instruments used by political and corporate elites to create today's unjust, destructive global economic order. The World Bank and the IMF have been quietly writing the rules that keep the world safe for multinational corporations, while economically depriving billions around the world. The IMF and the World Bank are in many ways the parents of the WTO. They operate together to preserve corporate power and constrain the rights and opportunities of the majority of the world's people. Because of that, many of the groups that helped organize the victories in Seattle are already preparing for days of protest, education, training, and direct action during the week of April 9th through 16th in Washington, D.C. The week will begin on Saturday, April 8th, at the Convergence site. On the 9th, there will be a Jubilee 2000 USA mobilization for cancellation of the debts of African, Latin American, Asian, Pacific, and Caribbean countries, and continuing with teach-ins and trainings on the global economy. Everything will culminate in a massive rally and nonviolent direct action at IMF headquarters, Sunday, April 16th, and Monday, April 17th. If you'd like more information about the mobilization for global justice to defund the fund, break the bank, and dump the debt, you can contact them through their website at www.a16.org. That's the letter A, the number 16.org. That's the Mobilization for Global Justice. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva. Up next, an interview with Brian Tokar on what is biotechnology and who controls it. The interviewer is Amishan Toft of Free Radio Forum.
Our guest is Brian Tokar, a professor at the Institute for Social Ecology and a founding member of NERAGE, Northeast Resistance Against Genetic Engineering. He graduated from Harvard with a master's in biophysics and has been working in the movement against GE since its beginnings in North America. He writes for Z Magazine, The Ecologist, Toward Freedom, and The Green Journal. His books include Earth for Sale and The Green Alternative, and he is currently working on a new book about the issues, implications, and development of biotechnology. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Michonne. Good to be here.
In a climate of increased corporate mergers and the consolidation of large-scale agribusiness, where farm prices are at a 50-year low, what is biotechnology, and how does it differ from the traditional ways that plants have been cultivated for human use during the past 10,000 years?
Well, biotechnology is really a whole range of technologies, and what they have in common is the simulation of basic life processes at the cellular and molecular level, and that can happen in a laboratory setting all the way up to a large-scale industrial setting. Of all the biotechnologies that we look at, the one that has gotten the most scrutiny and also presents the most problems is genetic engineering, which of course is the means by which scientists and the biotechnology industry are able to cut and splice fragments of genetic material or DNA from one organism to another. Now, the industry people constantly try to make the case that it's only different in degree, but not in a qualitative sense, from what they like to call traditional, quote-unquote, biotechnologies, like plant and animal breeding and what have you. And in reality, there's almost no relationship whatsoever. I mean, certainly they all involve some level of manipulation, but any kind of breeding activity relies on the processes through which living things have evolved and shared genetic material and created offspring for the entire history of biological evolution on Earth. There are ways things happen that are increasingly well understood and that are, for the most part, quite clearly defined, even if we don't understand all the nuances. Genetic engineering completely violates the patterns of natural breeding and natural evolution. It ignores the barrier of the species, and the species is an entity that's emerged as the basic, if you will, unit of reproductive integrity over 4 million years of the evolution of life on Earth. Genetic engineering violates the barrier of the species. It makes it possible to move DNA from bacteria to plants, from plants to animals, and vice versa. Even human DNA is being experimented with and inserted into the genetic material of various animals. And the insertion of foreign DNA happens in essentially a completely random way. Whether the foreign genes are incorporated with by manipulating viruses, which is one common technique, or whether they use the so-called gene gun, in which high-energy projectiles, basically gold particles, are coated with DNA and shot into a cell. In any of those cases, the incorporation of the new DNA into a cell is totally at random. And that's why the success rate of experiments in genetic engineering is so low. They have to basically try to infect hundreds of thousands, in many cases millions of cells, in order to get a few successes that they can then grow up in the laboratory. So in ecological terms, what this means is that we're seeing new combinations of genetic traits that have probably never before existed in nature. That's something that can happen through breeding, where chromosomes exchange components, but based on genetic traits that have similar locations on the genetic map and similar functions. Here, things are moved around, exchanged, and cut and pasted in ways that where the consequences are really not predictable.
So who founded and developed this new technology?
Well, genetic engineering originated in the 1970s, and it was a product of coming together of maybe half a dozen years worth of research into bacterial and viral genetics, through which various enzymes were discovered that make it possible to cut DNA in pieces and move fragments around the genome. Of course, it incorporates all the knowledge around how genetic material is replicated and transcribed and translated going back to the 1950s, to the initial discovery of the double helix by Watson and Crick. But two scientists at Stanford University named Cohen and Boyer in the early 70s were the first to succeed in transferring genetic material from one organism, I think it was from an amphibian, into a bacterial plasmid, which is a fragment of DNA in bacteria that actually functions somewhat independently of the main chromosome of the bacteria. So these are small little circles of DNA that bacteria do pass around among themselves. And the use of plasmids, of course, immediately raised the concern that these genetically engineered bacteria carrying foreign DNA would then be able to spread that information in unpredictable ways. And that's a concern that we're still dealing with. One of the ways scientists deal with the fact that this technology is so unreliable is they put a marker gene in along with whatever genetic traits they're trying to exchange. And those marker genes usually confer resistance to a common antibiotic. And we're seeing now more and more antibiotic-resistant diseases. And the question has been raised, particularly by scientists in England, as to whether this might have something to do with the fact that there are antibiotic resistance genes floating around all over the place now in configurations that didn't exist before the beginnings of genetic engineering. So anyway, back to the early story. In the 70s, they learned how to begin cutting and transferring DNA. Very early on, the scientists involved in this work started going commercial. By the time I was in graduate school in the late 1970s, all of the well-known scientists in the field were either working as consultants to corporations or were involved in starting their own specialized biotechnology startup companies. Now, this was a time when any kind of corporate money in science was universally seen as a corrupting influence, and this was very controversial. And labs that were getting corporate money from Monsanto and other companies that were aspiring to get ahead in this emerging field of biotechnology, those scientists were initially really looked down on by their colleagues. They were seen as compromising the independence of science, compromising academic freedom. They weren't able to publish their findings in the open scientific literature because they had to give the companies that were giving them grant money the right to go over their data, see if anything was patentable, and make sure they had control over those inventions before anything was released publicly. So this was seen as a real violation of the whole means by which scientific knowledge is developed. Today, the relationship between academic science and corporate biotechnology is so close that these questions are almost not being raised at all anymore. So we have technology that's been developed with an eye toward commercial purposes from the beginning. And at this point, we have 25 years of research, much of which has been very specifically geared toward the commercialization of new scientific information. So when people ask the question, why can't we prove conclusively that genetically engineered products are harmful? I say, well, it's going to take a long time for the research on the hazards to catch up with 25 years of this intensely commercially driven research. That doesn't mean we don't understand the hazards. We actually understand them pretty well. Initially, we were able to understand them by inference from what we know about ecology and what we know about genetic regulation. In those years, the company said, well, you haven't proven it. Now the evidence is starting to come out, and we're seeing more and more. We're seeing a new important paper in this field now every couple of months, still by no means as fast as the pace of the commercially driven research, the corporate research that's oriented toward profit making and not toward scientific knowledge in it by any stretch. But the research is starting to come out, and it's all affirming what some of us have been saying since the late 70s and early 80s about the risks to the environment of the release of genetically engineered organisms that can
get out in the wild and reproduce and infect wild organisms in completely unpredictable ways. The problems with damaging effects to the health of beneficial insects, of plants that are genetically engineered to be insecticidal or pesticidal, the hazards of increasing herbicide use with crops that are genetically engineered to tolerate higher doses of herbicides, and on and on.
You're listening to the Free Radio Forum. My guest is Brian Tokar, and we're discussing the relationship between the U.S. government and corporate interests in the field of biotechnology.
What is the relationship historically and currently between the government as a regulating body and these corporations as commercial entities?
Well, the relationship has always been very confused at best, and insidious, to look at it more skeptically. Many of the same agencies that have tried to regulate research using these technologies are the same ones that are funding the research, most notably the National Institutes of Health, which was the first agency of the U.S. government to take steps to try to regulate, to try to control for some of the potential safety problems of this technology. Back in the late 70s, they started issuing safety guidelines for genetically engineered organisms. But the NIH is also actively funding research in this area. In fact, the NIH guidelines in reality only really applied to research that the NIH was funding. The NIH has no jurisdiction over corporate research. And corporate research using genetically engineered organisms is, to this day, for the really, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that it's really completely unregulated. There's some regulation of food products through the FDA, although that's minimal, and various people who follow the machinations of the FDA have documented, and it's just a really blatant revolving door relationship between the FDA and Monsanto and the other biotech companies. And that played out in the battles in the mid-90s around the labeling of products, of dairy products from milk from cows injected with Monsanto's bovine growth hormone, where it turned out the people reviewing the studies and writing the regulations, many of them had worked for Monsanto or worked for companies that were under contract to Monsanto or offered legal services or what have you. So the FDA pretty much looks the other way with respect to most of the potential food safety hazards. The EPA is supposed to look at the environmental effects, but the EPA is so overworked and so understaffed that the EPA is really in many areas, not just genetic engineering, whether you look at toxic chemicals or species loss in our forests or what have you, the EPA is really only able to take on in a serious way issues that they're under tremendous public pressure to look at. And the forest movement, people say if you want the EPA to look at something, you've got to sue them to get them to take something seriously, to get them to carry out any kind of enforcement action. So in this area, the EPA's oversight has been very lax. They've generally only been able to review corporate studies, and that's been true in the FDA level as well. Rather than independent studies, all they get to do is look at the data that the companies want them to look at. And of course, the companies only want them to look at the data that's favorable to getting their products on the market. So the FDA mostly provides a rubber stamp. And then the last agency that's involved in this is the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, which is supposed to be involved in looking at effects on other crops and what have you. And the FDA happens to be the home of some of the most rabid proponents of genetic engineering in the United States. When the Vermont Ag Department did their little dog and pony show on biotechnology for legislators back last fall, the representative of the USDA there was more rabid and more overtly, he was more enthusiastic and more willing to exaggerate the benefits of biotechnology than even the representative of the biotech industry organization. So these are the agencies that are supposed to be regulating biotechnology, and the simple answer is they don't. You know, in 1986, The Reagan administration threw out a 10-year interagency process that was supposed to result in a comprehensive set of regulations specifically for products of genetic engineering. They just threw it out. Some of the remaining protections that existed were then thrown out in 92 during the closing months of the Bush administration, when the so-called President's Council on Competitiveness that operated out of the office of none other than Danny Quayle basically removed even some of the limited controls and reporting requirements on genetic engineering that we have. So we have this patchwork of agency jurisdiction that ultimately leads to no meaningful regulation at all. When people raised concerns a couple of years ago about genetically engineered potatoes that have a bacterial toxin in their genome and that secrete this toxin in its activated form at high doses out of every cell in the plant, including the potatoes, of course. The FDA said they couldn't regulate it because they have no jurisdiction over pesticides, and the EPA said they couldn't regulate it because they don't have any jurisdiction over food. So nobody's in charge, and that's deliberate.
How has the intensive development and marketing of this technology changed the face of agriculture in the United States and in the rest of the world?
That's a big question. For one thing, this technology has driven, and in some ways is also driven by at the same time, in kind of an accelerating circular process, an unprecedented concentration of corporate power over all areas of food production and healthcare as well. And we've seen this series of mergers since the mid to late 90s of agrochemical companies, seed companies, and pharmaceutical companies. We have now, for the first time, three giant multinational chemical companies responsible for something like 20% of all of the world's sales of seeds. 20% of all the seeds in the world come from Monsanto, DuPont, which owns Pioneer Hybrid, and Novartis, which was formed as a merger of two already pretty large Swiss multinational chemical companies. So we have unprecedented control by chemical companies over the seed industry. We have companies like Monsanto selling farmers packages of seed and the chemicals that those seeds have been genetically engineered to grow best, along with particularly Monsanto's herbicide Roundup being sold along with supplies of Roundup-tolerant seeds, particularly soybeans and corn, that have been genetically engineered to withstand high doses of Roundup, which is a general-purpose herbicide that kills most leafy plants. So the way seeds are sold has changed, and then along with that comes a legal change whereby instead of farmers buying seeds and then with crops like soybeans, say, that are open-pollinated, that for the most part aren't hybridized, farmers save seed from year to year and work on developing their own varieties in many cases. They're also trying to eliminate that practice, the 10,000-year-old practice of farmers saving seeds and doing their own seed production and their own plant breeding. Farmers who have been convinced to grow genetically engineered varieties, and there's tremendous pressure, especially in the Midwest, where farmers are beholden to agribusiness companies in everything they do. Rather than being sold seeds, they're literally licensees for technology. They have to sign a licensing agreement on the seed package that looks very similar to the licensing agreements you see on a package of software. By breaking this seal, you agree to the following three pages of small print that nobody understands. The same thing is happening with seeds now. For farmers in other parts of the world, the level of outrage just around that aspect is very profound, because the idea of seeds as a commodity, as commercial entities to be bought and sold and traded and something you have to go to a merchant and buy every year, is something very foreign, especially in most traditional societies in a lot of the so-called third world. Still, the seed is really is a symbol of fertility and of the continuity of life and of the continuity of agricultural ways of life going back in many parts of the world thousands and thousands of years. The idea that farmers here in the West view the seed as a simple commodity is itself an outrage. Then the imposition of all of these other legal and technical requirements compounds that. And then for many third world farmers who were aware of these issues. The ultimate outrage, of course, was the development of the Terminator seed, seeds that are genetically engineered to produce plants whose seeds are sterile. When news about the Terminator got out, especially in countries like India, where farmers are organized and have a much greater political understanding than in most parts of the world of the politics of agriculture, of what went wrong with the so-called wonders of the Green Revolution of the 60s and 70s and so on, the Terminator became a symbol of everything that's wrong with industrial agriculture and with corporate control, particularly by Western companies. Even in India, Monsanto has been involved in buying some of the country's largest seed companies. So it became a symbol for everything that's wrong with the whole system of corporate control over land and food and all aspects of people's lives.
You are listening to the Free Radio Forum. My name is Amishan Toft, and we're here with our guest, Brian Tokar, a veteran activist and writer in the movement against genetic engineering.
What has the resistance to biotechnology accomplished as far as reclaiming local control over food production, educating society about the root causes that have given rise to the degradation of biodiversity and political control in the 21st century?
Well, the resistance to biotechnology is very widespread. In India, of course, I mentioned that farmers have been in the forefront of this. And in India, there have been demonstrations of as many as 500,000 farmers against corporate control over seeds. In Europe, the resistance of farmers and ordinary citizens to the assault on our food and the land and the integrity of ecological relationships that sustain life on Earth has been a huge issue. Biotech issues have been front page news in Europe, particularly in Britain, but in continental Europe as well, for quite a number of years now, and increasingly consistently. And they've been able to pressure companies and pressure whole countries to really change their whole patterns of food importing to keep genetically engineered products out. France, in 98, France reduced its corn imports from the U.S. by more than 90%, and that was because they know that corn coming in from the U.S. has genetically engineered stock mixed in with the conventional non-genetically engineered varieties. So it's really galvanized opposition all over the world to this phenomenon of corporate control over food. And people who are involved in opposing biotechnology in many cases are also involved in reclaiming the integrity of their local food systems. Here in the U.S., a lot of the impetus for beginning activism against genetic engineering has come from people who are concerned about food. It's come from the organic movement. It's come from the co-ops. Even some of the commercial natural food companies have begun to be pressured into signing pledges and making public statements that they won't use products of genetic engineering. There's been enough pressure that even some of the agribusiness companies are having to make those kinds of pledges. And what it's doing in very preliminary ways is beginning to reassert the ability and the right of people to have control over the basic decisions that determine the quality of our lives. When a company like Nestle, the largest food company in the world, has to agree, in Europe at least, they haven't done it in the U.S. yet, that they're not going to use or they're going to begin phasing out the use of genetically engineered ingredients. Or when Gerber Baby Food, even though it's owned by Novartis, which is the biggest biotech company in the world, has to agree here in the United States that they're no longer going to use genetically engineered ingredients, that's a sign that people are beginning to take some of our power back from the corporations that want to be able to control every aspect of our lives. And I think that's really important and an inspiring beginning to a movement that I think has a long way to go, but that is increasingly aware that this threat of our lives and our basic relationships to the land and our food and to each other are being taken away. People are increasingly coming to understand that these institutions need to be opposed and need to be critiqued and need to be understood at a systemic level that's grounded in a real understanding of how the capitalist system works, of how the profit motive distorts all human relationships, of how multinational companies have rights that ordinary citizens in most countries don't even have. And that in order to stem the excesses of genetic engineering and other potentially destructive technologies, we really have to get to the roots of capitalism, of the whole corporate system and how it works, how it functions, how the economies of the countries of the world are oriented to advance the interests of those institutions over the interests of ordinary citizens, how political systems have evolved hand in hand with capitalism to further the interests of a system that ultimately really only benefits very few people.
It's been truly exciting to see the labor unions finally joining hands with Earth First in the last couple of years. In Seattle, we saw 40,000 union members march against the WTO alongside groups representing virtually every spectrum of the activist movement, as well as citizens and faith-based groups. At the same time, biotechnology has been creating ties within the agricultural community, helping to illustrate how it relates to the bigger picture of corporate mergers and the consolidation of economic power by non-accountable institutions. How have you seen this shape the dialogue around biotechnology?
Well, people involved in opposing biotechnology are very much aware of the role of institutions like the WTO in laying the ground for the kinds of concentrations of power that we're talking about. Monsanto wouldn't be able to impose its technology on people and countries around the world if, for example, the WTO weren't enforcing the patentability of living things. One of the provisions of the GATT agreement that created the WTO in the mid-90s was something called the TRIPS agreement, which is a sub-agreement under GATT, which basically stands for trade-related intellectual property rights. And what that has done is has allowed the U.S. to go around and literally force other countries to pass patent laws that are parallel to ours. Now, the U.S. was the first country where the patenting of living things was sanctioned by our court system. It began with a Supreme Court decision back in 1980, and the legal situation around the patentability of living things in this country has gotten worse and worse ever since. And with the WTO, the U.S. has been able to go to countries like India that have steadfastly refused to allow living things to be patented and said, you're in violation of the GATT rules. The WTO can impose sanctions. You better do something about it. And it's been a huge controversy. It's been in the national parliament. It's on the national news. And to us, it seems like this very legalistic, abstract question around patenting. But again, for people whose livelihood depends on the kinds of relationships between communities and the land that many people in this country have forgotten about, these issues are not so abstract. Labor hasn't gotten directly involved in the biotech issue yet, although it's clear that a lot of the companies that are most aggressively promoting biotechnology are ones that have histories of horrific labor practices. In the 1980s, Monsanto was in court over evidence that showed that they had committed fraud in hiding the effects of dioxin and other toxic chemicals on their own employees. They basically falsified health studies on their own workers and came under increasing public scrutiny around that. And in all of our work against Monsanto, we've tried to really look at the whole history of that company, going back to their role in the production of PCBs starting in the 1930s and Agent Orange that was sprayed all over Vietnam to defoliate Vietnam during the war in the 60s and 70s. Their continuing assaults against their own chemical workers and on and on. I think the biotechnology industry is a crucial piece of the whole picture around globalization. It's the technology through which corporations, again, are consolidating their control over our food and our medicines and so many areas essential to life. The technology is encouraging increasing consolidation, partly by virtue of the fact that the laboratory techniques and the databases of genetic traits and what have you often have common applications in food production and in pharmaceutical research. So all through the late 90s, there were these series of buyouts and mergers of biotech companies involved in food and involved in medicine. Now, interestingly, in 1999, that whole process began unraveling. And it began unraveling because the opposition to genetically engineered foods became so strong in so much of the world that investment firms started telling their customers to pull money out of agricultural biotechnology. It began with Deutsche Bank, the largest bank in the world, last fall telling people to pull their money out of DuPont because of DuPont's ownership of Pioneer Hybrid. And now we're beginning to see the reversal of some of that process. We're seeing companies like Novartis and AstraZeneca spinning off their agricultural divisions. We're seeing Monsanto's stock value go down and down and down to the point where their drug division represents almost the entire Wall Street value of Monsanto, and all their agricultural products, including herbicide manufacture and 8 or 9 of the world's biggest seed companies, are considered virtually worthless by Wall Street. And now with Monsanto being bought up by the pharmaceutical giant Pharmacia and Upjohn, they're going to have to raise the money to at least partially spin off their agriculture division. And if they're unable to raise that money, which is quite likely, we might begin to see something that would have been impossible to predict even a year ago, which is the breakup of Monsanto and its whole biotechnology, seed, agrochemical empire.
You're listening to the Free Radio Forum. My guest is Brian Tokar, and we're discussing the growing movement against genetic engineering around the world and how it's coming to fruit here in America.
There's an international trade fair in Boston put on by the Biotechnology Industry Organization in the end of March. What is this, and who is going to be there?
Well, the Biotechnology Industry Organization is the trade association for the biotech industry. It was actually formed only 4 or 5 years ago through a merger, again, of two separate trade associations. One was more involved in agriculture and the other was more involved in pharmaceuticals. And at the same time that the corporations were all merging and buying each other out, the two trade associations merged. So every year, Biotech Industry Organization, has a huge convention and trade fair. And for the last couple of years, there's been increasing public opposition to those events. These are the largest gatherings of biotechnology executives anywhere in the world. At the event in Boston at the end of March, they're predicting 7,000 participants from all areas of biotechnology, both corporate and academic. They're inviting celebrities, they're inviting their lawyers, they're inviting their PR people, and they're going to be holding their event at the Heinz Convention Center in Boston. In 1998, when Bio met in New York, there was a small demonstration coordinated by Greenpeace and some local activists in New York City. In 1999, in May of 99, Bio's convention was in Seattle, and at around that event, there were about 200 people in the street demonstrating against the biotech industry convention and holding an alternative teach-in in parallel.
I understand that there are a number of groups working on creating a counter-conference that has been dubbed BioDevastation 2000. Who's been working on this, and what is BioDevastation?
Okay, well, we're anticipating that this March, when Bio has their convention in Boston, we're going to see the largest coming together of biotechnology opponents that we've ever seen in this country. The word biodevastation actually goes back to an event that happened in St. Louis, right in Monsanto's backyard, in July of 1998. That was really the first large gathering of grassroots anti-genetic engineering activists from all around the world to take place in the United States. And at that event, the first biodevastation conference, there were about 300 people from probably 7 or 8 different countries. We heard from scientists and activists and people involved in all aspects of this debate. And then on the last day, we had a very colorful and very international demonstration right at Monsanto's headquarters on a summer day in St. Louis when it was about 100 degrees outside. The second biodevastation gathering was hosted by Vandana Shiva's Research Foundation on Science, Technology, and Ecology in New Delhi, India, and a small handful of activists from the U.S. and Europe had the opportunity to be invited to India and participate in what was just an incredible couple of days of discussions followed by a chance to travel around and visit some of the people in India, some of the farmers in India who are really working to reclaim their traditional agricultural methods and take control back from transnational agribusiness. The third biodevastation conference is the one that I mentioned that happened in Seattle in May of last year. Again, that was the first sizable demonstration at one of these industry conventions. And what we're hoping will happen in Boston, again, is the largest yet gathering of biotechnology opponents in the United States. We're going to be holding a two-day conference in Boston the 2 days before the bioconvention begins, the 24th and 25th of March. That's a Friday and Saturday. Again, we have an international roster of speakers. Vandana Shiva will be here from India. We've invited and gotten a tentative commitment from José Bové, the best-known spokesperson for the farmers' movement in France. That last summer succeeded in basically shutting down McDonald's all across southern France in protest against transnational corporate dominance of food and particularly U.S. sanctions that have been imposed on France and other European countries for trying to protect the health of their people by restricting or preventing imports of beef from cows that are injected with hormones. We have a large delegation coming from England, including a wonderful bunch of folks, a folk rock band called Seize the Day, that are really the house band of the anti-biotech movement in England, as well as representatives of the Genetics Snowball Campaign and UK Greenpeace and several other groups from England, and activists from all over the U.S. and Canada, who over the last couple of years have begun creating the kind of movement at the grassroots that's beginning to really expose the lies of the biotechnology industry. There are people involved in critiquing the scientific aspects of biotechnology, including a number of scientists who used to work in the biotech industry and over a period of time came to understand what's really wrong with genetic engineering and have become open critics. We're expecting lots of farmers, lots of people involved in understanding the international implications, and very importantly, people who are also involved in critiquing the whole area of biotechnology in medicine. Even a lot of people who are critical of genetically engineered food are sometimes seduced by the idea that medical biotechnology is really the key to all sorts of wondrous new medical developments that we've been promised. Yet all of these technologies, from the new reproductive technologies to the cloning of animals and ultimately perhaps the cloning of people, somatic cell and germline gene therapy, the technology that we're told will give us the ability to have designer babies in the future, the whole myth around xenotransplantation, the idea that animals can be genetically engineered so that their organs will be usable for human transplants, people from the disability rights movement who see very disturbing implications in the whole eugenic myth that this technology will lead to a higher level of perfection of the human genetic stock. A lot of the people who are most thoughtful and have done some of the pioneering research and really trying to critique that whole area and expose its underside are going to be with us in Boston as well. So the conference is on the 24th and the 25th at Northeastern University. And then many of us on Sunday will be going downtown. We're going to have a big rally, hopefully in Copley Square in Boston. People are making props and making puppets and writing songs and designing skits. And we're going to have a festival of resistance against biotechnology in the streets of Boston on Sunday. And then from Monday on, affinity groups prepared for nonviolent direct action are going to be participating in a whole series of direct actions focused on the abuses of the biotechnology industry while their convention is happening. So I hope everybody who's listening to this will get in touch with us, find out about our plans for Boston. You can check out the latest information as plans develop by looking at our new website, which is www.biodev.org, B-I-O-D-E-V, or you can send us an email at NERAGE, which again is Northeast Resistance Against Genetic Engineering, NERAGE@saver.net, or you can call our toll-free phone number for our activist clearinghouse in Boston, and that number is 877, that's one of the new toll-free exchanges, 877-9-RESIST. So I hope people will get in touch with us and come join us for what promises to be a historic event in the development of the opposition to genetic engineering in the United States and around the world.
All right, we'll be looking forward to it.
Thanks for joining us, Brian.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Brian Tokar, activist and writer in the movement against genetic engineering. His books include Earth for Sale and The Green Alternative, and he's currently working on a new book about the issues, implications, and the development of biotechnology. For more information on Biodevastation 2000, you can visit their website at www.biodev.org.
The Free Radio Forum is a production of the Free Media Network. For more information about today's program or to inquire about further programming, please email us at freemedianet@hotmail.com. Our mailing address is Free Media Network, P.O. Box 76, Plainfield, Vermont 05667.
We'll conclude today's program with a quote from a local hero, Frederick Douglass, 19th century escaped slave, abolitionist, journalist, public servant, and champion of racial and gender equality. Douglass believed in the power of written and spoken language to effect positive change for oneself and society. He wrote and spoke constantly on the need for all people to respect each other and themselves, and to struggle against illegitimate authority. The quote that I'm about to read is from a speech delivered on August 4, 1857, about West Indian emancipation from the British Empire, but its ideas and sentiments were never more relevant than today, as people rise up against the tyranny of corporate empire. "Let me give you a word of the philosophy of reforms," said Douglass. "The whole history of the progress of human liberty shows that all concessions yet made to her august claims have been born of earnest struggle. The conflict has been exciting, agitating, all-absorbing, and for the time being putting all tumults to silence. It must do this or it does nothing. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom, yet depreciate agitation, are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters." This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Find out just what a people will submit to, and you have found the exact amount of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them, and these will continue till they are resisted, either with words or blows, or with both. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress.
Man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. Go riding in the damp, foggy midnight. You snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know.
us amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest.
If you are putting on a community event here in the Finger Lakes region, or know of an event elsewhere that you think WEOS listeners should know about, please contact us so we can announce it on the program. You can reach us via email at unwelcome@radioforall.net. That's unwelcome@radio4all.net. Unwelcome Guest also has a website where you can follow links for more information on the speakers and issues discussed on the program, and also listen online to past programs you may have missed. Our website is at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's www.radio4all.org/unwelcome. Thanks for tuning in to Unwelcome Guests. The music used in today's program was Israelites by Desmond Decker and Fitter Happier by Radiohead. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.